Welcome to A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Linda Palacio, and I'll be your host for this half hour as we explore another topic in culinary history. And today, we are brought to you by Fairway, like no other market. And we invite you to call in to Heritage Radio Network at 718-497-2128. Well, today on Taste of the Past, I am very pleased to have with me a friend and colleague, Kathy Kaufman.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Kathy's a professional chef and a food writer, well, a culinary historian. And Kathy has written on several different periods, but mostly ancient periods, I think would say, is your specialty, right?
I've certainly spent a lot of time digging around in the dusty archives.
And not only writing, but Kathy has recreated dinners from some of these old texts, ancient texts, and put on full dinners that have been quite successful, I might add. But we're having her here today. She is the author of Cooking in Ancient Civilization. Cooking in Ancient Civilizations.
Four civilizations.
Many of them. Which is a publication in the Greenwood Press's Daily Life Through History series. And today I chose to have her talk about the very beginning, the Mesopotamians, the cradle of civilization.
Exactly.
All right. And what did they eat? And basically, we can say, why do we care? Historians have paid so much attention to this period.
Well, they've paid a lot of attention to the period because it's the time when we have our first writing. It is the shift from prehistory to history, the cuneiform tablets that I base a lot of my recipes on. And no, I don't read cuneiform. They have been translated. I only wish I could.
And we'll talk about those tablets in more detail later.
Exactly. But it's the time where we can first really start to read and understand what people were thinking and try and get into their heads because they're writing.
And how does that really, I was trying to kind of grasp an idea of why the cooking of Mesopotamia and their food culture really has such an impact on today's culture, if we could narrow that down.
Well, it certainly does on a couple of different levels. First, the climate in Mesopotamia. It has changed a little bit since 4,000 BC, when the area was first brought into the agricultural realm rather than hunting and gathering. But it's still got a lot of the same ingredients that are very important. And what you have always seen in Mesopotamia is it's a mixture of ethnicities. It's not just one ethnicity. I mean, we see it today in, you know, the politics of Iraq. Mesopotamia is essentially Iraq, and we know that there are different cultural influences there. And the same thing was true in ancient times. There were Sumerians, Babylonians, Hittites, Persians at one point, all sorts of different influences coming in.
And that's what makes the cooking of Mesopotamia so interesting, too. I mean, it's really... Yeah. And not only that, but as you briefly alluded to, which we will get to in further detail, too, is agriculture. Because give us a timeline. What are we really talking about here in terms of how far back are we going of things that we know were happening? 3,000 BC? Or
we go back into prehistory for the dawn of agriculture. The so-called Neolithic Revolution, the New Stone Age, is basically when people started shifting from hunting and gathering to more settled communities with agriculture and farming. Wheat and barley were two of the most important products in the ancient Near East, and they continue to be very important there today. And it's not really until about 3000 BC that we get our first writing in Mesopotamia, and it's another 1300 years or so before we get our first culinary writing, but we do get that around 1750 BC.
And reference this to any other culture that we know, we don't have any culinary writings that we know of until?
Well, we know that they existed in ancient Greece, but many of the texts are lost. We do have some fragments from around 300 to 400 BC, and then the first real cookbook that we have is actually a compilation that starts roughly around the beginning of the Christian era and more formally put down around the 5th century A.D.
So we're talking about a big gap in time. Well, we'll get into that in more detail. We have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll find out the details of Mesopotamia here on A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, and you're listening to A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network, brought to you today by Fairway, like no other market. We're talking with Kathy Kaufman about the foods of Mesopotamia, or the Mesopotamians, since they are such a broad range of people, ethnicities.
And ethnically diverse, and what they ate, well, a lot of bread, or a lot of grain products.
That's really what I wanted to focus on right now, is that we find in this era agriculture, which did not exist. We had hunters, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. hunters and gatherers. I mean, they found what was on the ground, or they went out and shot their meat. Let's talk about agriculture and grains and how that evolved in what we call the cradle of civilization.
That's a very interesting story that has a lot of different components to it. It's hard to pinpoint a kind of tipping point in which hunter-gatherers suddenly became agriculturalists. And most people seem to think that this is a process that took place over time, many different places, and we can't really pinpoint a specific time. But what we do know is that around 10,000 BC, there are evidence of places where foodstuffs were stored, particularly grains, and something that you could go off and hunt for a while when the hunting season was good, and then come back to where you had stored various things and, you know, basically overwinter based on these supplies of grains. Whether they were made into porridges, which seems to be the first use of the grains, or flatbreads happened very early. All we know is by the time people started writing about food, they were talking about rather sophisticated bread recipes. In Mesopotamia, in one of the palaces that's become an archaeological site in Mari, there were more than 300 molds for different sorts of breads. Hmm. So clearly they were doing some amazingly sophisticated and beautiful breadstuffs, and that was certainly for the elites how you would be eating.
Well, and fire. I mean, first of all, we didn't even go back that far. They had fire.
Oh, absolutely.
and that was so important.
Oh, well, fire is
separates us from the
fire
the
is a huge, huge issue. And it's thought, actually, there's an interesting theory that's come out recently from a guy at Harvard, that without fire and cooking, we never would have been able to evolve our larger brains. So it is fire that makes us human. It's not that humans captured fire. It's that fire and cooking allowed primates to become human.
All right. Interesting. So did they have, they really didn't use ovens. They didn't, even then, they didn't really build ovens, or did they use the molds? How did they bake the breads?
Well, there would have been things essentially like a modern tandoori oven, those clay ovens in the Middle East. They're now called tanurs, and there was a very similar name in ancient Babylonian for them. And you would basically heat the oven very, very hot, slap a thin bread against the wall, and, you know, in about 90 seconds, it would have been cooked through enough on one side and sufficiently done on the other side that you would have this flatbread that would be a little soft on the top, a little crusty on the bottom. It would often get topped with cheese, oils, various sorts of condiments, and that would be a standard part of your daily meal.
And cheese, of course, would be seasonal. I mean,
Well, it's seasonal, but keep in mind that cheese is a way of preserving milk.
That's right.
So while you would actually have, you know, milking season during the spring and summer months when the animals were nursing their young and you would take some of that milk and save it, you would turn that into a cheese or a yogurt. And the, you know, harder and drier the cheese was using salt and smoking techniques, you could have cheese year-round. It was not necessarily limited to the spring and summer months when fresh milk would have been something that, you know, milk the cow in the morning, finish it off because it's going to be sour by the following day in the heat of Mesopotamia.
Right, right. And, well, that's, once again, the geographical location is interesting in what was happening and how agriculture came to be, or actually farmed, harvested crops. Talk a little bit about Mesopotamia and a little geography lesson.
Well, a little geography lesson. I think we've all learned a lot of geography about Mesopotamia with recent politics, but you've got the Tigris and Euphrates rivers that are going through Mesopotamia, and they are something that, like the Nile in Egypt, would flood every year. As a result, they would moisten the ground and deposit a, you know, thick layer of silt, and that would enrich the ground so you would be able to grow grains very, very successfully.
And you mentioned barley and wheat being the two most stable crops or the important grains.
Interestingly, wheat was originally the more popular of the two grains, and it makes better bread than barley. It's because of certain proteins that are in the structure of wheat that are not in barley that allow you to have leavened bread. But over the centuries, because the Tigris and Euphrates were also depositing a salty silt onto the land, wheat started becoming less prominent because wheat requires a more finicky sort of land to grow in. Barley is very tolerant of extremes of heat, extremes of cold, and a salty soil. So barley actually became the more popular grain in later Mesopotamia. And you see lots of references to barley breads.
Well, it could be used for a lot of other things, too.
barley? Are you thinking about beer, Linda?
Oh, it could be.
Yeah, it certainly could be. And Mesopotamia was definitely a beer culture. When you think of the climate of Mesopotamia in the third and second millennium, it was a little hotter than it is now. And you really couldn't grow grapes. Grapes were something that were imported from Greece. There, believe it or not, there was a wine trade that goes back to at least the fourth millennium. Shocking to me, but wine was traded actively. The grape was originally thought to come from an area in northern Iran and spread to Greece. So the wealthy Mesopotamians would be importing grapes either from northern Iran or from Greece, and would have wine for their more elite meals. But the average schmo and even the average well-to-do schmo at the palace would be having an awful lot of beer as well.
So barley was coming in handy in both realms.
Bread and it was basically beer was thought of as liquid bread. And it's a role that it has played throughout a lot of different societies as being your staple.
I liked how you had explained in your book, and I must say Kathy does a wonderful job in her book of not only does she have a history of the food in the different ancient civilizations, but she actually has given recipes for some of these older techniques. But what I wanted to mention that I liked was how you summed up this whole civilization era that and around the agriculture, because of course you have grains, as you mentioned, you need a storehouse.
Absolutely. And if you don't have a storehouse, you're never going to have surpluses.
And if you have a storehouse, you need someone to look after it doesn't get pilfered, right?
You need someone to guard it. So you have to have divisions of labor within the society. There are going to be some people hunting and gathering, some people guarding and cooking. And as you get better and better at having surpluses, you can get people specializing in all sorts of things, you know, including beautiful pottery that goes back for thousands of years, fabulous gold and silver work. I mean, there's some gorgeous, gorgeous drinking cups for the beer that are made out of gold and silver, that are crafted to look like various animals. I mean, stuff that we would be very impressed if a silversmith today made it. And it's just very stuff.
They didn't waste time in front of the video game, I guess.
I guess so. You could develop other skills.
In essence, I mean, if you have storehouses, you have to have someone watching after it. Someone stays around there. So the nomadic tribes become more settled. Then all of a sudden you have a village, right?
And you have a village, and then you get a town, and then you get a walled city, and that's where you have your palaces.
Well, we know they ate more than bread, so we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about more than bread. This is Linda Palaccio. You're listening to A Taste of the Past, and we're talking about the Mesopotamians today and what did they eat here on Heritage Radio Network. And we're sponsored by Fairway, like no other market. And we're talking with Kathy Kaufman, culinary historian, and who's also written a book on ancient cooking in ancient civilizations. We were talking about bread, Kathy.
Yes.
I have a question about bread. I mean, I know a lot of breads, porridges were referred to as breads, or flat cakes referred to as bread. Any kind of mixture of grain was always referred to as a bread. But then at a certain point comes leavened bread. Tell me about that.
Yes, the great mystery of leavened bread. How did it develop? That's something that we have theories for. We don't have a definite answer. What seems to be most likely, and it's unclear whether this developed first in Mesopotamia or possibly in Egypt, and it could also be a situation of two independent developments. But when you are brewing beer, you get natural yeasts, and those natural yeasts can migrate into a bread dough. And once they migrate into a bread dough, suddenly that mass of dough starts to rise. And if you're hungry enough and want to just, you know, throw it on the hot stone to see what's happening, you'll get something. It'll be light and spongy. And if you like it, you'll do it again. In fact, it's really thought that leavened bread probably was a byproduct of some fermentation process before we had settled cities.
Accidental, huh?
Completely accidental, and probably an experiment that got repeated hundreds and thousands of times before people decided, this is really how we're going to do it. We're going to try and nurture these yeasts and keep them going. Of course, sourdough breads, which that's what we would be talking about here, are things that have nurtured people for so many years. It was, you know, the thing that made San Francisco famous in the gold rush.
And I remember in the 70s, we had pass it along to a friend. You start a sponge and it would sit on your counter for 3 months, and you'd pass a little bit to a friend and you keep using it and using it.
You would do that. And
like a chain letter.
Sometimes it would stay. Sometimes it wouldn't, and when it stank, you got rid of it after a while.
That's interesting because I think a lot of people aren't aware that that breads were more than just the flat, you know, the flatbreads I think of in ancient times, that they actually had the yeast.
They absolutely were, and it's interesting that the beer yeasts maintain their popularity as a way of leavening bread for thousands of years. If you even look at 19th century American cookbooks, they will tell you, use barm. And what's barm? It's a beer yeast.
Brewer's
yeast. So this is something that, you know, we've really only lost in the past 100, 150 years.
Well, and you say a lot of things like yeast and leavened breads, it's hard to pinpoint. We don't have proof. But going up a couple thousand years.
Oh, yeah, let's time travel. Why not?
Yeah, right. This is all irrelevant to today's anyway, but so many years, so much happens. But we do have the tablets, which are written in hieroglyphics in the...
in cuneiform.
Cuneiform, which... interesting. I have not seen... Did you actually see one of the tablets? Yale has three of the extant.
I have not seen the tablets in the stone, so to speak, but I have seen photographs of them.
I have seen photographs, and I've seen then reprints from the tablets on paper. Amazing. If we can explain to the viewers size.
The size is, fairly small.
About the size of a palm, like your hand,
perhaps. Yeah, I think a little bit bigger than that, but they're not tremendous. And it's almost as if you've got some sort of dental tool or something like that. It's assumed that they were made from a little metal or wooden carved implement that would then impress in the wet clay a triangular shape, which is basically what the cuneiform comes down to. And depending upon how many you group together and what angle you had them at, people who read cuneiform can literally read this stuff.
I was amazed at how much material was packed in such a small space. And there, you're talking about, you mentioned like 35 recipes in three tablets?
35 recipes, and what's interesting is that none of the tablets is complete. They've all got cracks and pieces missing. So while we have 35 recipes, none of them are 100%. So we have to infer what we can into some of the recipes. Certain recipes are really very, very full. There's one of my favorites is for what I call Mesopotamian cocoa vin. not truly a cocoa vin because at the time these tablets were written, chickens were not part of the Mesopotamian diet. They are an eastern bird that would only slowly make their way in, and they would hit Persia sometime around 1000 BC and get into Mesopotamia a few hundred years later. But it's a recipe for something called a kipu. And we don't know what a kipu is other than it's some sort of bird. And it's made with leeks and mint and some vinegar. So when you put it all together, and it's cooked in a crust. So it's kind of like a deep pot pie. And the instructions go on fairly extensively about, I will do this, and then you should take the onions and the leeks and do this, and then we put it on a big
not like the
platter.
Twitter recipes we know today.
No, this could not possibly be a Twitter. There's a theory that this recipe is actually a teaching recipe to teach a young priest how to make certain dishes for religious observances. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense that when you have relatively limited writings, you've got pharmacological recipes, you know, drug stuff, that's important. You need your religious recipes. That's certainly your religious instruction.
Which is a huge source of our culinary history.
Absolutely.
And information.
This one is thought to be a teaching recipe for a young priest.
Well, now I learned a brand new word when looking through your chapter. Mm-hmm. Not the only thing I learned, but it was a very interesting one for me. And that was when the culinary arts finally, or cooking actually, finally became an art or a craft, and you pinpoint it somewhere around 1900 BC as reference to a title?
There's a very interesting lexicon that comes out around 1900 BC, actually before the recipe tablets were written. But what it does is it gives you in two different languages, Akkadian and Sumerian, words identifying culinary preparations. Most of them are for stews or things cooked in liquid. And obviously, both subcultures were enjoying similar things. But then there is a word for the embellisher of food.
I love that, the embellisher.
Yes, the mubanu.
Mubanu or mubanu.
I'm not going to say.
Mubanu.
I'm not going to say that I am pronouncing it correctly, but it is the embellisher. And the idea is that someone who was essentially the chef in a food establishment would present the food beautifully prepared, or as beautifully as could be. And we know from religious records that fruits were often offered to the gods. They'd been carved and beautifully presented. So this might have been one of the responsibilities.
Well, it describes it so beautifully. Speaking of fruits, tell me, what were the fruits that they would have been eating?
Well, one of the biggest fruits would have been dates, because mm-hmm. the date palm does beautifully in the hot climate, and it's also extremely nutritious. It has a huge amount of iron, so even if you're not eating a heavy meat diet, which meat was available, primarily sheep, goat, a little less cow, a little less pig, but they were all there in smaller amounts, mm-hmm. You could get a lot of iron out of the dates, and that would have been an important staple food for Mesopotamians.
So they had dates, they had, we know olives came later. Olives came up from the Levant or whatever.
Yes, olives came a little bit later, but they were important. They actually used sesame and sesame oil very much in the cooking, more so than olive oil. Olive oil, it's like, you know, getting a good Italian extra virgin. It's a little bit of a luxury, not an extensive luxury, but it was still something that was a little more expensive than the sesame oils would have been.
And citrus, which we assume is indigenous in that region, in fact,
citrus is not there. The only thing that might have been in Mesopotamia at the time is a cousin of the lemon called the citron. But there was no citrus. That came in much later from India.
Well, before we have to go, just kind of describe for us quickly what, let's say, as we get later on in the era of Mesopotamians, what a typical day's eating plan would be.
Well, the Mesopotamians, and let's talk about someone of
Babylonians, let's say, as far as that period.
Some wealth, so they're not subsistence hand to mouth. They'd probably have four meals a day, a little snack in the morning that would be bread, possibly some cheese, fruit, and importantly, milk, glass of milk in the morning because the cows had just been milked. There'd be a lunch that would be similar to the morning snack, but a little bit lighter. Then dinner would be much bigger. You would have various pulses, you know, chickpeas, lentils, that sort of thing. Fish, if you are in any of the ancient cities on the Tigris or Euphrates, you basically had free fishing and
could go and
get lots of fish. There might be meat. And the most important thing would have been pastries and honey, things sweetened with honey at the end. And there are actually some amazingly delicious Mesopotamian pastries. We have lists of ingredients that went into them. And with a little imagination, you can put it together and make something really fabulous.
And you do have recipes in there, which are amazing. I just, with all this talk about salt and everybody needing to cut mm-hmm. down on salt, I did want to make reference to what they use to season their foods, to make it salty, to make it seasoned, and talk about, just briefly, because
we're running out of time. They could use salt, but salt was primarily used as a preservative, so you would salt fish, other things. And when you salted fish and left them in that hot sun, you would have a controlled fermentation, and that fermentation would result in a liquid that they called siku. Now, if you've ever read anything about Roman dining, you've heard about this thing called garum, which is, depending upon who you talk to, this kind of putrid anchovy.
I've tried making it.
anchovy thing. But it's really very much like a fish sauce, like a nunc mam or a nam pla. Right. And it, very, very similar in quality. And that's how you would add salt, in the same way that Southeast Asians add salt.
But then you snuck in a little bit about it wasn't always made from fish, fermented fish. What was the delicacy that they loved and made their preserved salt locusts
and they could make things from locust. And the interesting thing about the locust is it was a mild hallucinogenic. So you would, if you had your salted locust and put that into your food. Well,
they'd eat anything.
They would eat anything. Yes. Let's make the locusts. The plagues were upon everyone. That was something that you read about in the Bible, and the Mesopotamians were certainly no different in not taking advantage of these things.
Well, clearly we have much more to talk about. So many other civilizations. So you're just going to have to come back another time, and we'll move our way along the timeline. And I just want to thank you for sharing all your information today, Kathy Kaufman. And the book is Cooking in Ancient Civilizations. I'm Linda Palacio. This has been A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network, brought to you by Fairway, like no other market. And I'd like to thank our producer, Lorenzo Raggianieri, and our engineer, Nat Wiener.